There would be many lonely hours ahead for me, and I thought it would be good to give them purpose. Did you put something in my wine, Mary? I'm just wondering how I'm keeping my temper. You just swan in, take my husband with one hand, and offer me a hobby with the other. Mary's hand hovered over mine. We're going to be all right. She flexed her fingers, closed her eyes, ecstatically, and breathed in and out. It was embarrassing, and I told her to stop making herself conspicuous. Sorry, she said, not sounding sorry at all. I had a lot of questions for her. Whether she and St. John could read others' thoughts, what her first memory was, things like that. The first thing she remembered was a shilling with King George of England's head on it. It had been very well taken care of, polished and kept clean, and it shone in St. John's dirty hand down where he crouched in the trench. He'd swapped something for it. She couldn't remember what he'd swapped, but she knew he'd wanted the shilling because it was bright. She told me about the first job St. John took after the war. He'd been a bill collector, but he doesn't say much about those times. It was fascinating listening to her. He was one of the best, Mary said, wolfing steak down as if she'd heard there was going to be a shortage. He hounded debtors door to door, plucking away the false names and new addresses they tried to hide behind. He developed a method. Firstly, he paid no visible attention to the poverty or misery of the people on his list. Secondly, once he caught up with them, he'd only ever say one sentence demanding what was owed. That was it, his method. He repeated that one sentence over and over without changing the formulation of it until he was paid. You should have seen him, Mrs. Fox. He was really kind of magnificent. Sometimes he'd get punched or interrupted or outshouted while he was saying his sentence, and, well, he'd just wait until the interruption was over. Then, rather than starting his sentence again, he just went on, as if nothing had happened, picking up from the precise syllable where he had been forced to stop. It drove people nuts. His collection rate was outstanding. It doesn't take much to horrify people who are already frightened. She frowned. He was good at being a bill collector, but it wasn't good for him. For days at a time, he hardly talked to anyone but me. And sometimes at the end of his workday, he'd walk into walls and closed doors. He saw them up ahead, but he just didn't stop walking. I asked her about the first story he wrote, and she told me about the crummy boarding house he was living in back then, just a bed, a desk, a chair, and a few easels, which he placed open books on to look at. Art monographs and cookbooks, poetry, a guide to etiquette, a dictionary, a Bible. He'd get back from work and walk from easel to easel, picking up fleeting impressions. Mary turned the pages for him. Gentility is neither in birth, manner, nor fashion, but in the mind. Next, and what if excess of love bewildered them until they died? And a woman is always consumed with jealousy over another woman's beauty, and she loses all pleasure in what she has. After that, be careful that the cheese does not burn, and let it be equally melted. Then he'd spend the night bent over his notebook, writing in zigzags, his pace irregular. She was very reluctant to answer my other questions about the war, and I thought it must be because of terrible things he'd done, or because he'd been a coward. But she said it wasn't that. If I answered the questions you're asking me, she said, you'd wish I hadn't told you because you wouldn't know what to say. I think he worries that people sneer at him for coming back safe and sound, or think that he must have been taken captive and put to work tending enemy vegetable patches. But just trust me, Mr. Fox was decent in those times. He did what he could, and he was as decent and as brave as he could be. We changed the subject. Mary told me she had been doing some reading of her own, Hedda Gabler and the Three Musketeers, so far. The women in these books are killers, she said, her voice escalating with each word, so that by the time she reached the last one, the diners around us were looking around for the killers. Did you think they couldn't be? I told her about one of my favorite villainesses, a flame-haired woman called Lydia Gwilt, who died changing her ways.
Of course she did, Mary said, frowning. This is worse than I thought. If you make the women wicked, then killing them off becomes a moral imperative.
My first thought was, but they're not real. And my second thought was, under absolutely no circumstances can you say that. You'll hurt her feelings. So I devised a title for the book I was going to write, Hedda Gabler and Other Monsters. And she cheered up at the assurance that everyone would survive. She wanted to experience things. She had a list. She planned to attend a big band concert, and she planned to walk through a field of yellow rapeseed, and she planned to get an injection and anything else I might recommend. She promised me she'd settle down soon, and I found myself telling her to take her time. Growing up, I was glad to be the only girl, with big brothers who teased me and acted with unerring instinct to keep the heartbreakers away from me. But it might have been nice to have had a little sister and to have helped her out from time to time with advice and chaperoning, etc. Mary said she was going to sleep in St. John's Lighthouse on Cloud Island. I told her I wouldn't hear of it. I wouldn't sleep for thinking of her all alone in that weird old place. But she'd already stolen the keys from him, and she said she thought it was nice out there. She said she liked to look at the sea, that it made her sing. The first time Charlotte Bronte saw the sea, she was about 17 or 18, I think, she was utterly overcome, she told me. She didn't seem to notice she'd slipped into a British accent, and I didn't point it out to her. I just listened. After all those years on the moors, she'd imagined what the sea was like, over and over, of course. How could she not? But when she saw it, it was more than she imagined. Didn't someone write, "There's nothing greater than the imagination"? I think that's nonsense, don't you? She said all this to me in the back of the taxi that was taking us home. She was sort of panting. Then she was out and out sobbing, and to hell with the static. I held her and smoothed her hair and pushed the dimple in her cheek till she was able to smile. You're very kind, she said. I'm sorry. It's just taken such a lot for me to get here. I saw what she meant. All I could do to help was treat her as if she was ordinary. Still, I had to know. I mean, it was a hell of a thing. How did you get here, Mary? We were fooling around with stories. We put ourselves in them, she said flatly, as if she didn't even believe herself. Too much awe, like someone explaining a house fire that burnt down their whole block. We were playing around with matches and gasoline. What? Where are these stories? Can I read them? She leaned forward and told the taxi driver to drop us off by the dock at Cloud Cove. I told her that the last boat must have gone an hour ago. I told her to come back with me. I told her that St. John would have to know what was going on sometime. That she was real now, that she ate steak and talked to the neighbors, and was probably going to have everyone in town, men, women, children, trying to get next to her before the week was out. I'll swim over, she said. I like having a secret from him. I'll be all right, honestly. Come and see me tomorrow, and you'll see I'm perfectly cozy out there. I looked back as the taxi drove away from the dock. She fiddled with her hair, seemed to be tying the lighthouse keys into a tight knot in her hair. That will be hard work to comb out in the morning. She peeled off my shirtwaist, my favorite lilac shirtwaist, discarded it and dived into the water. The taxi driver saw her, too. He raised his eyebrows, but not too high. He was a taxi driver. He'd seen a lot of things. Well, it is summer, and she's from out of town. That's all he said. St. John came out of his study as soon as I opened the front door. Very quietly, he told me that Greta had phoned for me. Oh, what did she say? I asked. Then I remembered that I was supposed to have been at dinner with her. And I shivered, a chill in my back that made me feel as if I was falling, even though I stood quite still. He shivered, too, much more noticeably, as if tugged by strings. She said she'd call back tomorrow.
Okay. I switched a lamp on. It was frightening to be with him in the dark, seeing him shiver like that and listening to him speak so impassively. When I saw his expression, I wanted to switch the lamp back off again. Anger. It was etched all over his face, the lines drawing up into a snarl.
Why did you lie?
I looked at him and didn't say anything. He took a step backwards, and I don't know how I didn't scream. He seemed to be readying himself to spring at me.
Are you going to tell me who you were with?
I don't think I could have managed a single word, even if I'd wanted to. I knew it looked bad, and it was going to look even worse if I told him who I'd really been with. It would look like mockery, throwing something he'd told me back in his face.
I think I'm going to knock you down, he said. If you just keep standing there like that, I'm really just going to knock you down. Go upstairs to hell. Get a room somewhere with your damn Pizarski. Just get out of here.
That stunned me. I don't know why I laugh when I'm hurt.
Oh, Pizarski. Oh, you'd like that, wouldn't you? Then you could put another plus in Mary's column. Doesn't run around with John Pizarski.
I turned towards the front door, but where, as a rational adult, did I mean to go? Did I mean to swim over to the island, as Mary had? Burst in on Greta and J.P. or the Wainwrights? I slid past him and went up to the spare room. I dragged a chest of drawers over to the door. It was just the right height for me to lodge a corner of it under the door handle, which turned 10 minutes later to no avail. Then he must have rammed a shoulder against the door. It shuddered, and my heart hammered in my ears. He did that just once, without saying a word. Then he went away. I sat up late, looking out over our garden. There was lightning, and rain battered the ground, and I thought of Mary Fox miles away, watching the storm through the lighthouse window. I thought of the things she knew about St. John. I saw a shiny shilling and a dark-haired young man with eyes like stains on glass, alone in a big city, walking into walls. Everyone hurts themselves in the city. Then they just pick themselves up so as not to get in anyone else's way. And then he went home to company devised for him alone. He went home to a girl who wasn't there. I envied Mary for being what she was, for being so close to him. I was so jealous it burned, and I knew I had to let it alone, or I'd break something inside me. The night changed me. I built a scene in my head better than that line I'd come up with about modesty and rouge. I pictured a woman alone at her dressing table getting ready to go on stage. She's exotic-looking, maybe dark-skinned, maybe an Indian. She's had hecklers before, guys saying really filthy things, and now she's really going at it with a makeup, just plastering it on, drama around the eyes, making herself look like a woman from another world, so the audience will just sit there with their mouths open and let her sing her song and get out of there in peace. And while she's getting ready, this woman is talking to someone sat behind a screen. I'm not sure who that someone is yet. Anyway, the woman at the dressing table, her heart's breaking. It breaks 3 times a week on account of people treating her so badly, and she knows that all you can do is laugh it off. She's saying, "Let me tell you something, kid. Love is like a magic carpet with a mind of its own. You step on that carpet and it takes you places, marvelous places, odd places, terrifying places, places you'd never have been able to reach on foot. Yeah. Love's a real adventure. But you go where the carpet goes. After you've stepped onto it, you don't get to choose a goddamn thing. Well, there'd better be a market for magic carpets, 'cause from tonight, mine's for sale." And that's how I plan to begin Hedda Gabler and Other Monsters. I think I'll cut the part about the magic carpet being for sale, though. It might come off as tacky. I moved the dresser away from the door at about 4 in the morning. I had to go to the bathroom. Then I went into our bedroom, mine and St. John's. He wasn't there. I went downstairs and found him in his study, asleep at his desk, drooling a little on some newly written pages so that the ink ran. I pulled the pages out from under his arms and put them aside without looking at them. He woke up, but he didn't open his eyes. "I can explain about dinner," I said. "In the morning. Just come out to Cloud Island with me, and I'll show you." He made no answer, and I pinched him. He opened his eyes then and gave me a sulky look. "How's the book going?" He winced. "Will you read me some, please? It's not ready. Just a little." He read a couple of pages aloud, very quickly. Then he saw that I wanted to hear more, and he slowed down. He writes beautifully, but without hope. Odd that he could be responsible for a little dancing cinder like Mary. He reached a particularly stressful part of a chapter, and I came to crisis and said, "Oh, Lord," before I could check myself. He looked up from the page. "Bad things are going to happen, Dee." "To the two of us?" I held out my hand to him. He took it and touched his lips to my wrist. Pins and needles, as if all my blood was rushing back into me. "Yes, to the two of us. It's inevitable. But good things are going to happen, too." He opened his mouth, seemed to think better of it, closed his mouth. "Were you going to say, I sound like Mary? Or Mary sounds like you?" I came to him without substance, and 6 years later I'm still the same. Sometimes I say terrible things to him because I don't want him to know I'm sad. Sometimes I fly off the handle to hide the fact that I don't know what I'm talking about. And other times, too often maybe, I don't dare have an opinion in case it upsets anyone. I'm too stupid for him. Have you ever heard a note in someone's voice that said, "This is the end"? I heard it in the next words he said to me, and I stopped listening. Have you ever wanted to try and cross an ending with some colossal revelation? "There's something I never told you. I'm a princess from the kingdom atop Mount Kaf, for example. My family live in eternal youth, and if you abide with me, you will too. I kept this secret from you to see if you would cherish me for who I am." Have you ever wished, wished, wished? My head got so heavy it sank down onto my chest. "So say whatever it is you think you've got to say, St. John. That you're not in love with me. That you need to be alone. Say it." "I'm not going to like it. No, I won't like it at all. But I'll be all right." I told him that I loved him. I've never ever said that to him before because I just don't know how he'd take it. "I love you." I mouthed the words because there didn't seem any point in interrupting him just then. I don't know if he saw. I hope he did, because I don't believe it's the sort of thing a woman can tell a man more than, say, 3 times in their life together. It's only really appropriate in the event of a life-threatening emergency. "I love you." It means a different thing to us than it means to them. God knows what it means to them. God knows what it means to us. Start again, Dee. "Let's start all over again," my husband said. He rested his hands on my shoulders for a moment and took them away. "Can we? Start again? Nice in theory. But what was he really trying to say? How far back would we have to fall? All that undoing." "Show your game, Daphne." "Sure," I said. I held out my hand. "Shake on it." We shook hands. He held on to my hand. His grip was tight, and our palms were sweaty. I looked up at him. He looked down at me. and I had absolutely no idea what was on his mind just then. I decided to wait, but after a few more speechless seconds, I figured he must not know what to say next. Maybe he was scared of saying the wrong thing. So I took the initiative. I broke the handshake and introduced myself. I said I was glad to meet him, and I asked him what his name was. I heard myself, all bubbles and sparkle. I'd had to drop my gaze to be able to pull off the playful act, though, and I felt him looking at me, still looking. I heard him stifle a yawn. Then he lifted my chin with his thumb. His lips grazed my cheek. My spine melted down my back. He murmured, "Okay." But I was wondering if we couldn't go a little faster than that. I slid my hands up under his shirt. My fingers spread across the bareness of his chest, shaking as I felt the depth of the breaths he took. It felt nice, of course, but really I was just stalling him, trying to think of a way to give in without letting him think he could always get his own way. I needed some phrase that was simultaneously encouraging and disparaging. "Well," he said, and he was so close, smiling just a little, his lips not quite touching mine. I just couldn't find that phrase I wanted. So I gave his nose a good hard tweak, all the better for being sudden. He gave a pretty satisfying squawk after that. So I kissed him. And laughing a little, he kissed me back. He kissed me like ice cream, like a jazz waltz, the rough, gentle way the sea washed sand off my skin on the hottest day of the year. And the whole time, there was that little laugh between us, sweet and silly. We rode the ferry across to the lighthouse in the morning, having slept too late to walk across. Mary Fox wasn't there, but she'd left us a note on the kitchen table with the keys to the lighthouse on top of it. "Gone traveling. To Mexico via Mississippi. Met a beachcomber who said he'd take me as far as Virginia. Not bad, huh? Don't know how long I'll be gone. Mrs. Fox, I'll send you a forwarding address when I know it, so you can send me pages of Hedda Gabler and other monsters. Don't forget to write it. And don't talk yourself out of it. You can do it, and it's going to be really good. Maybe I am slightly magical after all. Mr. Fox, don't worry. I'll come back to you. Maybe you'll be nicer to me once you've missed me a little. And hey, now you can do whatever you want for a while. I'm dying to know what it'll be like when I come home. The three of us. I almost wish I was there and back again already. Take care of each other, okay? M.F. We'd found my shirtwaist by the dock, just where she'd left it, crumpled and ruined by the rain, so I could only hope she had some clothes on. St. John read the note over and over, his lips moving silently. He looked both stricken and relieved. I suspected that in the next few minutes he was going to start quizzing me pretty hard. As for me, I'd noticed just how similar Mary's handwriting was to St. John's, and was thinking that perhaps a break from Mary Fox wasn't such a bad idea after all. Some Foxes, Part 1. The little girl feared the fox cub, and the fox cub felt exactly the same way about her. The woods went on for many miles, and a few foxes lived at the heart of it, and didn't encounter people if they could help it. Yet the girl and the fox cub had been pointed out to each other. The girl's mother had used a picture book, and the fox cub's mother had brought him to peer in at a window once, when everyone in the girl's house was sound asleep, and each had been told, "That is your enemy." They grew up a bit. He learnt things, and so did she. They didn't unlearn their fear of each other. The girl was pretty, though, and stubborn and strange. And the young fox was curious and courageous and clever. It was only natural that they would find each other. The young girl was in love with mystery and secret knowledge. She learnt the names of demons and summoned them. They never materialized. She didn't take offense. She wouldn't have bothered either if she were them. The girl lived with her mother and her elder sister at the mouth of the woods, only a few steps away from town. Less than 10 steps, probably. Still, they didn't get many visitors. In the evenings, the elder sister studied and studied, but our girl set up lanterns in her room and performed puppet shows with marionettes she'd made herself. During his long illness, the girl's father had shown her how to make puppets. Then he'd died. "Come away from the window," the elder sister would say sharply whenever she saw what the girl was doing. "Don't draw attention to us. Who knows what's watching from the woods?" But their mother intervened and told the elder girl to leave the younger be. Our girl sang songs to accompany her performances, and the puppets cast shadows on the leaves and the grass outside her window. Our young fox observed all this from a distance. He stood stock still, his narrow eyes just a faint shimmer amongst the shrubs. He heard the singing. The sound meant nothing to him, though it did not displease him. The fox knew about fox business. By now his mother had moved on somewhere, and he didn't much miss her. His paws were swift, and he wouldn't let his eyes confuse his mind, so he was good at catching rabbits and squirrels. He slept late and woke early, and travelled the whole wood wide, tasting the weather. He knew where the bees went to make their wild honey. He saw when cuckoos visited the nests, and knew which birds were going to get a nasty shock come hatching time, and he waited for the spoils. The fox fought no one. He took things easy. When it was time to run away, he ran. What can it mean for a fox to approach a girl? Foxes are solitary. A fox that seeks out human company is planning evil, or it has something the matter with it, rabies, or something worse. The fox watched the girl at play. And he didn't understand what she was doing. It certainly wasn't fox business. Still, it interested him, and he gazed and gazed at her as she sat surrounded by all that greedy, dangerous fire that she kept in jars. He gazed and gazed, though it served no purpose to do so, gazed without feeling satisfied, and with the sensation of a deep scratch in his side. This was an awareness of time and its disappointments, the certainty that the girl would put out the lamps before he had looked his fill. And it was through observing the girl at play that our fox learnt to recognise beauty elsewhere in the wood. Whenever he became caught up in useless looking, he knew. Moonlight on the water brought rapture. Think of a fox dipping his paws in silver, muzzle dripping. He didn't want to drink the water, only to touch it while it looked like that. Another fox came by and laughed at him, but our fox didn't care. As for the girl, she looked into the darkness of the woods, and she saw very little. Occasional motion, perhaps, but nothing definite. Our girl developed a distaste for fact. She stopped going to school. Her mother kept a shop in town, selling food, books, toys, linen and anything else she could think of, and she did very well out of it. The girl joined her mother at the shop counter. She refused to sell people things she didn't think they needed and argued with them until they saw her point. The elder sister grew more wan and studious, folding herself into her textbooks because she didn't like to live in the mouth of the woods where things she couldn't see crept and shuddered all hours of the day and fell deathly still when she turned to look at them. The elder sister wanted to get away and go to a city and be unknown and kick up her heels and have fun. All in time. She needed to get top marks first and go away on a scholarship. "What's to become of you?" the elder sister asked the younger, who shrugged and laughed and looked out of the window and dreamed. "Have you forgotten our fox?" The one who now had an eye for beauty and an inclination to set it apart from other things. The fox wished to thank the girl. The fox wished to know the girl. It took him a long time to make his mind up. He wasn't happy about it, but he didn't have a fever, and he slept well, and his appetite was fine. So he thought he must be well, and that everything was all right, and that maybe, just this once, the things the elder foxes had said were wrong. So the fox brought the girl berries, plump, rust-red berries, wrapped in the largest, greenest leaf he could find. He left the leaf out overnight first, so that it sparkled with dew. How to give them to her? He watched and waited. The evening puppet shows had become less frequent. This was because the girl was becoming interested in young men and had begun dressing up to go out to dances with her sister. Their mother had previously refused to let the elder sister go alone. "Young men are animals," she said. So there were dances and blushes and letters written and exchanged and sighs of longing, and the woods didn't seem quite as real to the girl any more. They were just some trees behind her house. A great number of trees, to be sure, but only trees. Men were quite interesting. They were new puzzles to work at least, and if she solved one of them, she won a new life and a new surname, and a companion who wouldn't tell her off for buying too many music scorebooks and new hats. These days the girl only tended to put on a puppet show when she'd fallen out with a suitor. Then a richly gowned female puppet berated a threadbare male puppet for half an hour at a time. The fox didn't like the new tone that the puppet shows had taken. Something about it. Anyway, here were the berries, and there was the girl and the lantern light. The time was right. He leapt up onto the windowsill with the leaf in his mouth, dropped it, and retreated, farther than a stone's throw, but not so far that they were unable to see each other. The young woman saw a streak of grey, saw a tail brush the windowpane, saw a green parcel fall, and her puppets fell from her hands with a clatter and lay on the ground with their knees bent as if they meant to spring up again on their own. The lantern flickered. The girl saw a fox a little way down the corridor of trees. The creature was watching her. She moved to the right, and its gaze moved to the right. She moved to the left, far left, almost out of the window's frame, and the fox's head moved with her. It appeared to be smiling, but that was just a meaningless expression created by the look of its muzzle. There was an unfaltering clarity to the animal's gaze, thought without emotion. And yet, the fox was quivering. It had brought her something, and it had stayed to see what she would do, and it was quivering. So the girl didn't draw the curtain, and she didn't turn away. She opened the window and slowly, very slowly, closed her hand around the bulky leaf. The fox did not approach. If anything, it drew further back. The girl opened the leaf. Berries. But they looked more like jewels. She tasted one, and it was delicious. She ate another and another, and she beckoned the fox. "Come here. Come here," she said in a syrupy voice she used with very small children. The fox did not approach. The fox looked desperately from the girl's eyes to her berry-stained mouth. She didn't like the gift. She was angry. What was she saying? What was she saying? "Won't you come closer? You're the one who sought me out, you know," the girl said crossly in her own voice. The fox had had enough for one night and fled. Now the girl wished to thank the fox. The girl wished to know the fox. She wrapped herself in a shawl, took a lantern in her hand and slipped out of the house, thinking that she would follow the fox to its den and see how it lived. Our girl raised her lantern as she followed the paths between the trees. She ducked under the bigger branches, but the smaller ones raked her hair. She gasped at first, but then the pull became so frequent that it was caressing, a sealing of hands. She stepped across shallow, pebbled brooks. Her skirt dragged in the water. The hem would be ruined, she thought distantly. The fox was nowhere to be seen. The girl stopped beside a fallen log and swung her lantern around behind her, trying to remember the direction she had come from. She couldn't remember. She was lost, and she didn't know what to do. She sat down on the log and cried. Unfortunate girl. Her tears were beautiful. From his hiding place, the fox watched her weep. All he could think was that she was doing something with her eyes, something that shone. He watched her until she fell asleep, and he kept watch over her while she slept. This happened in winter. There was ice in the earth. When the sun was down, skin and clothing were of no use outside. You needed fur or feathers, or you needed to be indoors. The girl caught a chill, a bad chill. Her breath cracked in her chest. She took a fever because her body needed the warmth. Her teeth chattered. She reminded the fox of leaves blown in the wind. When she woke up, she was weak. And, much to the delight of the fox, she lay on her log and wept again. Without knowing it, she'd walked a long, long way into the wood. Sunrise dazed the redwoods, birches wept, and so did the girl. Eventually, she chose a direction and began to walk. The fox followed her, wondering where she was going. Home, her home, was the other way. Discreetly, he rattled some branches. She noticed him. And then he ran, too fast for her to catch him, but slow enough for her to keep up. The girl could hardly believe that she was following a fox again. It could be taking her anywhere, to her death in a deep pool, to a shallow pit crammed with tiny bones. Perhaps it didn't even mean for her to follow it. Perhaps it was just bounding along, enjoying its morning. The fox never looked back at her. A different fox? She heard the search party before she saw them. The air rang with the sound of her name. The fox swerved and dashed past her back to the heart of the wood. She put out a hand just in time and felt its warm fur against her palm. There were no more puppet shows after that. Snow fell. The girl sank, and the girl shivered, and the girl raved, and the girl died. The cause of death was twofold. The extreme chill she'd taken alone in the night, and the berries, which were poisonous. The fox didn't know what was happening. He dared much, so he returned to watch the house. All the curtains were drawn. Steady lamplight escaped from a gap at the top of one pair of curtains, the pair in the girl's bedroom. He lost interest after a few nights of that view, and returned when he next remembered. There was no light that night. The whole house was dark. It was the same the next night and the next. The fox was philosophical. From the moment he had recognized loveliness, he had known it couldn't last. And he returned to fox business. Part 2. Now I will speak of another kind of fox. The other fox was a grey fox. This one is red. I am speaking now of a fox who had been hunted, a beast of the chase who was only alive because of luck and cowering and grim fighting, grim and miserable and low. This fox wasn't innocent. He had turned hutches into bloodbaths purely to divert himself. But he also knew wounds and weariness, had crawled into holes and lain like a rag wadded deep into the ground. He killed hens because they were there to be killed, and he understood that the hunters sought to do away with him for the same reason. The fox had started his life in a den heaving with cubs, but they'd all been hunted down almost as soon as they were grown. A few times he'd hidden alongside foxes who had been bred in captivity, but they never got away. Their wits were dull. The horizon made them run around in circles, confused. This fox had no one. I've said that foxes are solitary, but there's a difference between having no one because you've chosen it and having no one because everyone has been taken away. I'm not saying that I myself know what the difference is, but our fox knew. One afternoon, the fox jumped some fences and walked straight up to a farmhouse. He didn't want to be a fox anymore. He didn't want to be anything. His head was down. So he didn't see the farm dogs looking askance. They bristled and growled, but they didn't attack, not even when the farmer's wife came out and commanded it. The farm dogs knew a sick fox when they saw one. The farmer's wife went inside, but she left the door half open. She was coming back with something. The fox looked at the ground. He appeared to be smiling, but that was just a meaningless expression created by the look of his muzzle. The fox had no plan. Something might happen soon, or it might not. Either way, he was here, at the end of his nature. A human form appeared near him. The dogs jumped to the sky and bayed in a way that wolves do sometimes when the full moon draws them. The fox didn't look. This person had been following him about for days. He couldn't remember when she had begun. He'd been badly hurt, and she was there. She was just there. She had sticky stuff that he had permitted her to smooth over his wounds. The wounds were just scars now. They'd healed fast. He had been too sore to move, and she had dug up voles and snapped their necks and scraped at them and fed him. With her five fingers and her funny flat palm, she had placed food in his mouth. At night, when he was in too much pain to rest, she counted stars and whispered into the hollow of the tree he lay in, telling him how many she could see, until he fell asleep. There was no reason for her to do such things. He didn't know what this person wanted from him, and he hadn't come across anything like her before, so she probably didn't exist. The fox ignored her as best he could. Now she crouched down beside him, and she touched him. She rubbed his neck. She spoke into one of his ears, and he understood. Whenever she spoke, he understood. Her voice had all sorts of sounds in it, the flow of water against rock, an acorn shaken in its shell, a bird asking for morning. Her voice wasn't loud, but he heard it throughout his body. Listen, that woman is looking for a gun.
A gun? Good. Even if the fox had been able to reply, he wouldn't have.
She's found the gun. Quickly, why did you come here?
The dogs became braver and crept close. She put out a hand and sent them away.
It's true then, fox, that you want to die?
He couldn't tell her the truth. He lacked the language. She sighed.
Very well. It is your right. Goodbye.
She stroked his back. She strolled away. The sound of the shotgun shattered the air and sent him after her as hard and as fast as he could go. They both ran, but he overtook her. All things considered, two legs, etc., she wasn't a bad runner.
Live! She laughed breathlessly. Live, live, live!
And when it was safe to stop, she collapsed against a stile in a fallow field and held her face between her hands and made noises that sounded like hick, hick, hick. Began to pay attention to her. Her eyes were set quite far apart. He'd never been so close to one of his hunters, had never been this close to harm. She told him that she'd looked after him because of the white hairs on his forehead that grew into the shape of a star. Sometimes you see that someone is marked, and you're helpless after that. You love. She wanted to tell him that. But she decided it was better not to. He hadn't known that there were such hairs on his forehead, or that such a thing could be of significance. She sat, and he lay near her, and a little time passed, quiet and bright. Then they had to go, in case the farmer had been told of their trespass and decided to look for them. They parted outside her hut. It was a ramshackle thing beside a stream. It had a heavily dented tin roof, and its windows were coated with dust. All in all, it looked cross, and as if it had plenty of things to say to its inhabitant about having been left alone for so long. "Come inside," the woman said to the fox. The fox demurred. Sadly, the woman watched him go his own way again. Days went by. The woman made peace with her hut. She gave it a thorough sweeping, built herself a new roof, washed the windows, plaited rugs. The woman picked herbs and grasses and boiled and bottled various concoctions. Sick people and their relatives sought her out in the forest. She took their money, and they took her bottles away and were cured.
"Where have you been?" she was asked again and again. "Weeks we've been looking for you."
And she answered, "I fell in love.
Congratulations! Where is he? I don't know. I don't know if I'll see him again. And her pupils grew vast as she spoke, as if her eyelids had been opened while she was still in the first stage of sleeping. Women like her are very serious once they have chosen. To everyone who saw her, she said, "If you see him, tell me. He wears a white star on his forehead." She didn't tell anyone that he was a fox. One of the village women went into labor, and our woman served as midwife. The days were full of screaming, and the nights were hoarse, and there were three of each until the baby was born. This happened in summer. When our woman came home, she jumped into the stream and washed. The blood and sweat whirled away, and afterwards she sat outside until the sun dried her. She watched lizards and felt humming in her skin. Tiny creatures bit her. They were alive and they wanted her to know. Her pulse slowed to its lowest ebb and sped up again, flashed through her wrists, in her head. She was happy and unhappy. "The fox has forgotten you," she told herself. Yet all around her she saw white stars. Because of a fox? Because of him. The woman went into her hut to find clothes to wear and found that she had been robbed. Bottles and picture frames were broken, her tables and chairs were overturned, her papers had been rifled through, matches were scattered on the ground. The woman searched the hut for missing things. She wasn't aware of all her possessions, so really she was just looking for a gap. She found it on her bookshelf. The thief had taken a dictionary. Nothing else. She stood looking at the gap and thinking. Then thinking turned to wonder, and she smiled into her hand. Now think of a fox in his den, wrapped round a book, his front paws are resting on the pages and his eyes are very close to the text. These shapes, they're useless. They frustrate him. The more he looks at them, the more they mock him. He nudges the book into a sack and drags the sack along by its drawstring through the forest. In the bushes by the village nursery, he listens to children saying their ABCs. He can see the blackboard. The teacher taps it with a ruler, going from letter to letter. His mind wanders. He bites his paw. Look and listen. His mind wanders again. He nips at his paw again, savagely this time, and again, until his paw is bloody and he is learning. First Light finds the fox at his stolen book. No one else knows. No one sees what he is doing. But words are coming. The fox doesn't hunt anymore. He doesn't hunt. He eats easy meat, forest rats. He stays near his den, or he goes to the nursery school. He listens carefully. He connects pictures with words. He eavesdrops. He steals newspapers. He stumbles in his understanding and snarls and shreds the newspapers to pieces. But he will know this language. He must have this language. Because of a woman? Because of her. The day came when the fox had words. Only a few, but enough to begin to talk to her. He went to the woman's hut. Her hair was grey and there were lines on her face, but otherwise she was the same. She had not been young when they had met, and 2 years had tipped the balance. He wasn't young himself. The woman smiled and touched his forehead, so it was still there, this shape that she liked. Good. Come inside, the woman said, in that way that he heard from head to toe. One day he would ask her how she could do that. The fox entered the hut. The fox had brought the dictionary back. She'd long since bought a new one, just as well, since the stolen one was falling apart. He had also brought words. He had chewed them out of newspapers. Long, patient work, and anxious work too, double-checking that each word meant what he thought it meant. If he had got it wrong, all wrong, if she laughed at him. The woman settled in a chair and watched the fox sort through scraps of paper. She was holding her breath. She believed. She didn't know what she believed. It could not be. The fox looked lean and crazed. In her mind, she ran through a list of concoctions that might do something for the beast. Words began to spread at her feet. Hello. The fox looked up at her and panted. He curled his tail around his leg in an apprehensive L. The woman raised her hand and let it fall. Hello, she said aloud. She couldn't see clearly. All these tears. She brushed them away. Can you help me? He was very intent as she spoke. She answered three times to be clear. I'll try. Tell me what you need. Quickly, remembering the afternoon at the farmhouse, she added, I can't help you die. The fox shuffled scraps of paper, chose two. Not die. He chose three more. Please change me. He thumped his paw on the last two words, his eyes on hers. Change me, change me. Change you how? Not fox anymore. He'd had to tear the word fox from the dictionary. It was tiny. No, the woman said slowly. No, I don't think I can do that. I haven't the skill. The fox lay down and closed his eyes. This lull, after all his striving, was enormous. It was like pain. The woman fell down beside him. Her pity made her do it. The woman and the fox faced each other, nose to nose. Then he stood, nudged her aside, chose more words. Stay with you. I with you. Please. The fox applied himself to living as the woman lived. He ate at the table with her and slept alongside her in her bed and scrabbled around with soap in the stream. He read voraciously. He read more than she did, and as more words came to him, he told her of the hunt, of the horses and the hounds behind, and sometimes there were falcons, like a rain of beaks and claws. The woman listened, and as she listened, she realized that she was hearing him, that he was saying words instead of showing her. She made no remark and treated it as normal. She asked him which he would rather be, if he could change, a horse, a bird, or a hound. None of those things, he said. At night, he suffered himself to be held, a thing that was unthinkable in the first days of their acquaintance, even when he had been very badly hurt. He had less and less trouble sleeping upright each night. Together, they built a bigger hut and a bigger bed. She saw that his claws had become thin and brittle. They were more like fingernails, very long nails, it was true. But they weren't claws anymore. But what teeth he had! So, the pleasure of biting, or letting him. And afterwards, the feel of a long wet tongue light against a hot wound. The different ways. The hidden bite, the swollen bite, the point, the line of points, the coral and the jewel, the line of jewels, the broken cloud. One medicine-making day, as they carried fresh water back to our hut in wooden buckets, he asked her, How old are we? And she answered, I have forgotten. She put down her bucket and tried to count years on her fingers. He watched her until she gave up, then put his arms about her. He stood a head higher than she did. What's so funny? She asked him. And he said, Nothing. Part 3. I almost forgot to mention another fox I know of, a very wicked fox indeed. But you are tired of hearing about foxes now, so I won't go on. Mr. Fox by Helen Oyeyemi was read by Carol Boyd.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.